Hi, I'm Beth.
And I'm Jimmy.
And we're the Talk to the Hand podcast.
Hello, Beth.
Hello, Jimmy.
How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. I'm going to be so British right now. I'm really loving that it's like there's signs of spring there. I know we've had a bit of rain recently.
It was raining this morning.
But the signs of spring are there.
Okay.
Does that not make you feel nice?
No.
A bit of warmer weather?
It doesn't, but maybe I'm just lacking some of the vitamin D that the sun would offer me.
Yes, you need that. You need that vitamin D.
So we've got a good episode today for the listeners.
We have a firm favourite of yours from the 90s, isn't it?
I know. This was one of those guilty pleasures, those secret vices that I had when I was younger in terms of music. So there were probably only two boy bands that I could actually say I really liked. Mm. One was Backstreet Boys.
Yeah, classic.
And this was the other one. But looking back, I think Backstreet Boys is perhaps a little bit more understandable. But you know, I'll own it. I used to like them. We're talking about E17. Originally, when I started thinking about this, I was actually going to do an episode on Brian Harvey. But as I kind of went through the thought process, I thought it would be more appropriate to do it about the wider group. So we're going to do an episode on E17. We really hope you enjoy it. But for now,
rewind to the 90s.
Tony Mortimer was born Anthony Michael Mortimer on October the 21st, 1970. Raised in a working class environment, he found solace in the vibrant and diverse musical landscape of East London. The multicultural influences around him contributed to his eclectic taste in music, which would later be reflected in his work.
In his adolescence, Tony Mortimer discovered his talent for songwriting and began honing in his skills. His talent brought him to the attention of London Records, who offered him a record deal with London Records after he presented his own material. That was until ex-Pet Shop Boys manager Tom Watkins suggested that what the world needed was a boy band antidote to take that and a band that bad girls could fall in love with.
Terry Caldwell was born in North London on July 21st, 1974. Now, Tony knew Terry's sister, and there was an awareness that Terry was able to dance. As Terry said when he looked back, "He knew I used to hang around at a derelict block of flats, and he approached me and said, 'Do you want to be in a band?' Now, Terry jumped at the opportunity and couldn't wait to go and see his friend to tell him that he joined a band. His friend, Brian Harvey, was chuffed for Terry, but also saw there might be room for one more. So he asked Terry to go and speak to Tony to see if he could join too. Terry didn't know Tony too well, so was a little hesitant to try and call in a favour, but he said to Brian, Tony was still around the corner, so maybe they should go and ask him together."
It sounds like a little playboy, yeah, playground stuff.
Yeah. Can you tell your mate my mate fancies?
Tony accepted, and having already added his former school friend John Hendy to the mix, the group were formed. The plan was that Tony would be the lead singer, John would provide backing vocals, and Terry and Brian, who were both 3 years younger, would be dancers.
However, when they got to the studio, Brian Harvey's vocals caused a shift in the plan and he was pushed front of stage, taking up the mantle as lead singer for the group. And we'll talk a little more later how that ended up causing some division. So the group name came from the postcode for Walthamstow, an area in London between the Old East End and the Essex commuter belt. And so, by some dilapidated Walthamstow flats, the band E17 was born. And of course they didn't shoot to fame immediately. And being a dance-heavy group, there were some routines they had to learn.
Yeah. We'd literally have a little stereo on the floor with tapes in it, and overnight, under a lamppost in the street, be practising these dance moves, says Terry.
Mortimer wrote the vast majority of the group's songs, which often contained rap verses vocalised by him to complement Harvey's more fluid R&B-style vocals. The group was usually seen as a grittier, more political and hip-hop or rap-aligned group than its rival boy band Take That. From the start, the plan had worked. E17 looked trendy, sang competently, and boasted an inventive musical repertoire. Their debut album, Walthamstow, shot to number one in the UK album chart. It featured a string of top 20 singles, including House of Love and Deep. It's All Right became a major success in Australia, reaching number one in early 94 for 7 weeks in a row, and number three in the UK in 93. And that same year, first of Brian's troubles emerged when he was fined for possessing cannabis.
Although Mortimer was always the brains of the group, adolescent audiences were quickly drawn to Harvey, a gifted vocalist who adopted a cheerful, rebellious attitude.
Under Harvey, E17 weren't afraid to swear or smoke or have girlfriends. They came across just a bit cooler,
yeah,
a bit more open to a wider audience of people who weren't just into the packaged boy bands. Mm. It just clicked for us, Brian recalled. We were so young, we didn't have a clue what we were doing, and we just got lucky.
Back then, as a kid, you made a choice of who you liked. It was either us or Take That. And if you liked E17, it showed you knew what was going on. You were clued up and better taste in music.
And that's his unbiased opinion, I guess.
Yeah, unbiased, obviously.
However, even from those early days, fractures in the group were already taking place. As John recalled, we were together a lot in those days, and there was always friction from the start. Brian had all the fame where Tony was overlooked but had the financial success, and I guess they both wanted what the other had. Tony was what you'd call the brains of the band. He did a lot of the songwriting and was busy in the background and was getting most of the royalties. But Brian got most of the attention. The newspapers loved him. He was straight talking and didn't care what people thought. He was the sort of person people wanted to interview because he did speak his mind. Wow, that feels like it's a real opening to what happened later, that ended up leading to the end of the band.
Yeah. In 94, with the launch of their second album, Steam, E17 achieved their sole UK number one single, Stay Another Day, which held the top spot for 5 weeks and became the Christmas number one of that year, which we covered in our Christmas number ones.
We did. If you want to hear more about that song, flip back to episode 22, and that was part two of our Christmas number one specials that we did over the Christmas period.
Yeah.
In 1995, the band played to 100,000 in Moscow's Red Square, then watched boggle-eyed as the usual stony-faced security services danced and sang along with the crowd. Some of whom, the band found out later, had sold their shoes to be able to attend the show. That's commitment.
Yeah, that is. In 96, the group reached the number two position with the song If You Ever, a duet featuring the singer Gabrielle. I like that one.
I like that one. And I like, we talked earlier, we mentioned some of the songs. I really like Deep.
Deep,
and
yeah.
It's All Right. They were pretty good songs, I thought.
Yeah. So E17 made an appearance on the Childliners record The Gift of Christmas, joining forces with M&A, Boyzone, EYC, Sean Maguire, Juice, Ultimate Chaos, Let Loose, Backstreet Boys, Peter Andre, Michelle Gayle, Danny Minogue, among others.
You really sweated up since I tested on those artists in a previous episode.
Did you know Tony actually wrote that song?
Oh, did he?
Yeah, I didn't know that until we did those.
I guess that would have been the only song he wrote that he didn't get royalties for. Because that was a charity record, wasn't it?
And it wasn't great, was it?
After the relatively subdued release of the album Up All Night, their decline in popularity compared to previous records was linked to Mortimer's decision to step down as the primary songwriter. The album's songwriting responsibilities was distributed among all four group members, although interestingly, Mortimer actually authored all the singles that went on to be released from the album. In 97 though, and this is where it all kicked off, Brian Harvey was engulfed in a drug controversy when he claimed he took 12 ecstasy pills in one night, saying, it's cool to take drugs. He also claimed that ecstasy can make you a better person. And Beth, I don't know about you, but I can still remember the photo on the front page of the newspaper with him walking his dog wearing this bright, horrible orange puffer jacket, smoking a fag. Yeah, it was a bad time for him because despite the tag the group had as being sort of bad boys, the comments went against the whole boy band image. Mm. And there was a huge media uproar, even to the extent where questions were asked in the House of Commons about it. The group's career and reputation were both tarnished.
We'd done something for Top of the Pops and I went to bed, called John. My missus woke me up and John Major was on the telly talking about it. I thought I was still dreaming. I was waiting to wake up. It was all over the papers for weeks with pictures of Leah Betts with tubes hanging out of her. And I look at it now as a dad and I can't imagine how her parents must have felt.
And that's the thing, at the time the Leah Betts tragedy was big news. And I mean, that links back to a whole other story from the 90s that we might pick up the whole Essex murders.
Mm-hmm.
That might be another story for another day, but the tablets that they were selling actually ended up with Leah Betts.
Yeah.
Because Leah Betts was, and we're going to be as transparent as we can be, because Leah Betts was from a certain class of people, her family were relatively well off and professional people, it made much more noise than when other deaths of ecstasy tablets had happened. And that made it really front page news in the major tabloids. And that had a massive impact on the country's view on ecstasy tablets. So the timing was horrific. Mm-hmm. And I remember not too long afterwards, I think it was Noel Gallagher who was doing an interview and said, actually, we take drugs as well. And I think we should really have an open, honest conversation about it across the country. And everyone was sort of like, yeah, I think you're right. We should do. But Oasis were in the ascension at the time, and D17 were already in the decline. Mm-hmm. And I think Brian Harvey's inarticulate way of putting it probably didn't help the argument he was trying to make. So Harvey was sacked as a result of his comments. Then Tony Mortimer later decided to leave. A couple of months later, due to creative differences between himself and the rest of the group. And then in 98, Brian Harvey was fined £1,000 for kicking a photographer.
So Harvey, Caldwell and Hendy all attempted a comeback in 98 under the name of E17.
So this was E17 rather than East 17.
Yeah. And landed a record deal with Telstar Records after recording an album's worth of self-written material in their home studios. Their first single, Each Time, reached number 2 in the UK. But without Mortimer's songwriting influence, the band struggled. And after rather disappointing sales of their next single, Betcha Can't Wait, reaching just number 11 in the charts, and their album, Resurrection, not selling as much as the record company would have liked, the band were dropped by the label in 99.
Now, I have to say, Each Time was a great song.
Mm.
I thought that was so this album, they'd gone down a much more R&B route.
Yeah.
And it was what Harvey and perhaps the others wanted to do for a long time. But Tony's was much more about political subliminal messages in the songs. And Brian Harvey wasn't really into that. He just wanted to sing R&B. And that Each Time was a really good song. Betcha Can't Wait wasn't so good. But Each Time.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure if you look in my 90s playlists, it's in there.
Yeah.
So after launching himself as a solo artist with the help of Wyclef, Harvey went back to E17 to play numerous gigs on the nostalgia circuit with Caldwell and Hendy. On the ITV1 docu-soap Redcoats, E17 was shown performing at a gig that was being held in Butlins in Bognor.
In October 2000, Mortimer was chosen as one of the 4 pallbearers at the funeral of gangster Reggie Quay. Didn't know that.
No.
Yeah.
Not connections I would have expected him to have, but maybe it was a profile thing. I don't know. In 2001, Brian needed plastic surgery after being attacked with a machete outside a Nottingham nightclub. In 2002, he was jailed for 56 days for breaching an injunction taken out by his estranged wife. In 2004, he quit I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, following a row with Janet Street Porter. And I remember an interview he did soon after that, and he said, whenever he'd watched it before, he always assumed that someone was like round the back bringing him in McDonald's and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Didn't realise you actually had to, work for your food and stuff. Mortimer attempted to create 2 bands, but each time opted to return to production work for other artists from his Essex studio. He also recorded his own solo material, released in January 2006, on his official website.
Now, Brian Harvey made the news in 2005 when he accidentally ran himself over and required surgical treatment. Harvey managed to fall out of his Mercedes while reversing and run himself over. He suffered broken leg, broken pelvis, damaged ribs and a crushed lung. He said, I spent 3 months in hospital. I couldn't even wipe my arse. At the time, he said something about feeling sick after eating a jacket potato. And he was a figure of fun. People found this hilarious and he was a bit of a joke figure by this time. But actually, it was quite sad. And there were also rumours that it was potentially a suicide attempt. Something that he's denied, but
yeah.
I don't know.
People always talk, don't they?
So on February the 4th, 2006, Harvey appeared on the UK television music show CV UK, where he announced that E17 might make a comeback with the original 4 members. In mid-February that year, the group reformed. They played their first concert since reforming on May the 30th at Shepherd's Bush Empire in London.
The group's breakup had affected Mortimer badly. He suffered eating disorders and agoraphobia and has aged less kindly than his former colleagues. He also became interested in spiritualism, and a visit to a medium was behind the group's reunion. I asked the question, will I ever perform again? And she said, yes, I see you on stage, and there's 4 of you performing.
After reforming for that one-off gig, it was reported that E17 had split up again, since Hendy was unable to fully commit to the band because of his roofing business, and that taking up a lot of his time. Friction also flared up again between Harvey and Mortimer, resulting in the latter's departure, and the rest of the boys performing as a 3-piece at various club events. Now, Tony had long had issues with Brian, and we talked about this at the start, Brian being brought in as a dancer and becoming the central figure and most popular member of the group. Now, back in the 90s, this clash caused a lot of tensions. Their former manager said, Tony loathed Brian. He wouldn't even travel in the same car as him. And today the animosity remains. They shared a stage at that concert, but behind the scenes they were barely speaking. And then the two became involved in a punch-up at a business meeting. Do you remember this on the documentary we watched some years ago?
I do. So with the record label Warner looking to discuss a possible comeback deal, Mortimer called a meeting with the band. Harvey, who was often disorganised, arrived an hour late. Recollections of what occurred next differ. Brian says, I walked through to say hello and he came walking straight up to me. I thought he was going to say something funny, but he didn't. He hit me.
Mortimer, for his part, recalls, he's done my nutting, so he's walked in and I've gone crack. Well, actually, I didn't. I said, why am I waiting for you? He went, what? So I hit him. Either way, punches were thrown, Brian got injured, and Mortimer was forced to resign from the reformed East 17.
Not good, is it? They join, they break.
Tony and Brian are so different.
Yeah, they are.
That it doesn't surprise me that they never got on. There was always stories about it, and Tony was quite a bit older and a bit more mature than the others, and maybe it's fair to say a bit less rough and ready. I always remember, like, on the album cover of Steam, I think it was, three of them were there with baseball caps on, but Tony never wasn't. Yeah. He didn't really wear the caps like the rest of them did, so he just seemed different.
Yeah. So performing as a three-member group without Mortimer, E17 played at Strathclyde University in Scotland on September 24, 2006, after DJ Colin Murray was unable to attend.
So Tony had that choice, but the other three didn't. Although during their heyday, the band generated tens of millions of pounds in record sales and endorsements, Brian, John and Terry were paid just a small weekly salary for their pains. The rest went to the manager, the record label, or was funneled into songwriter royalties. Tony ended up with 8 million, recalls Caldwell. I had to sell my home because I couldn't afford it. I never had the sports cars or any of that. In fact, I earned more money selling my house when I got divorced than I did in 8 or 9 years at the top.
It's sad, isn't it?
Well, a bit later we tell how much they were earning, but I can tell you now. £125 a week. And they were hiring cars and, you know, they were turning up in big cars with the dog. Mm. They didn't realise they were paying for that. So that was coming out. The money was going to the record label. So although they were being paid £125 a week, maybe they would have been paid more if their expenses weren't so high, but they didn't know any better.
Yeah. Today, Terry lives in a flat near Walthamstow with his girlfriend and new baby, Brooke. At this time, he was travelling to E17's gigs 2 or 3 nights a week in John's Citroen van, with a ladder on the roof. We were young and naive and nobody told us how the business worked. We didn't know what was going on. We got paid £125 a week. The way I see it, others did well out of the band's success and we were left with nothing.
John ended up having to remortgage the house he shared with his wife and daughters. And as I said earlier, he ended up leaving the group to focus on his roofing business. Brian Harvey has been banned from driving for 6 months. That was in 2008 after being found guilty of going nearly double the speed limit. Brian had gone back to his pre-fame trade as a plumber. The fact that Brian even needed to go back into plumbing is again because he earned so little from his time in the group. He also made an attempt at Eurovision but wasn't selected. And the only one of the four who came away from the band really well off was Tony, who along with Watkins made the lion's share of the profits from their success. He now lives behind the security gates of a mock Tudor pile on the edge of the Greenbelt. Members have come and gone in the band and they still perform today, but don't expect it to be anything like what you remember. Terry is in it with two other random blokes as they travel around on the 90s circuit.
So, but for me, that's not E17, they're not E17 or whatever.
Well, a lot of this comes down to ownership. So when the three of them released each time, do you remember they went from East 17 to E17?
Yeah.
I think, and I don't know this, but I'm imagining that London Records or Watkins, the manager, or someone owns the rights to the name E17.
Yeah.
So now, presumably, someone who's got the rights to the name E17 have let them use it for this band.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's how they go around at the moment. Brian has had some negative press in relation to his mental health issues. Now, I don't want to go into a great amount of detail here because it's very, very controversial and it's all out there if you want to go and look at it. Mm. He has a YouTube channel and the allegations he raises are serious and disturbing and they would also be hugely libelous, hence my desire to steer clear. He did turn up at Downing Street demanding to speak to David Cameron in 2014 with a binder apparently detailing how much the government had stolen from him. whatever the truth or otherwise in his allegations, it's a really sad situation. So there are clips of him being arrested at his home for stuff he said and done, and he's had public spats with his ex, Daniela Westbrook. Yes, do you remember they were together in the early days and they kind of fell out? And the subject matter he talks a lot about is around paedophilia.
Yeah.
That's what he talks about a lot, and there's various things he says, and he actually released a record on the subject as well.
Okay.
But because I don't know all the details, I don't really want to go into great depth on it, because frankly I can't.
No.
And it's very difficult to get to the bottom of what he is actually saying, because there are hours and hours and hours and hours of videos going through. And it's very complicated, names of people, and there's accusations that were made against Watkins.
Yeah.
What might have happened with someone else that was in the group and that kind of stuff. So it's really a sad situation.
Yeah, that is, isn't it?
So as we conclude our journey through the tumultuous and fascinating story of E17, I can't help but feel sad about how it all turned out. From living the dream together, none of them even speak to each other today. Remember, these all knew each other as kids, or most of them knew each other as kids. And they won't even speak to each other these days. So the thought of another reunion is so far off the cards.
Yeah.
The aftermath of Brian Harvey's comments on ecstasy and then the departure of Tony Mortimer led to a decline in popularity. The band's later years saw a series of reinventions and comebacks. Their struggles with fame, internal conflicts, and the relentless pressure to meet the industry expected standards provide a raw and honest look about the realities faced by those in the spotlight. And that is the story of E17.
Like you say, it's sad, isn't it? It's sad that they don't talk to each other. It's sad that they knew each other before, they knew of each other before in the band.
It is really sad. As I say, E17 were one of my hidden guilty pleasures. The one you never told anyone that you liked.
Yeah.
It was one of those. But yeah, I guess there was something different at the time.
I think they were needed, because I get that sort of the rivals to the Take That band, the sort of the pretty boys.
Do you remember we talked during the episode on 5 about that whole thing, that they were created to be the bad version of Boyzone?
Yeah.
Well, E17 were created to be the bad version of Take That, I guess.
Yeah.
I always felt E17 were a little bit more believable. We talked about some of the backgrounds of the guys in 5. Well, the background of the guys in E17 were pretty much the same. They were all from a similar sort of background as each other, from the same local area.
Yeah.
It just felt a little bit more authentic, and they used to walk on with the dog that they used to have. And
Well, they've said it, but you couldn't imagine Flat 5 having a little stereo under a lamppost, can you?
No.
In an estate.
And none of E17 were privately educated. No, I mean, that much was obvious. Although Tony, I don't know, because he turned up playing a lot of instruments, his inability to play the piano and all that kind of stuff. Now, someone from Brian's background wouldn't have probably had that opportunity to do. So I don't know, but I've seen various documentaries, and I'm a sucker for them. I can't help but watching them. But I remember seeing one. It went through Brian Harvey after the incident where he ran himself over, and he was going out with that. Is it Emma B at the time?
Oh, yeah.
She was basically nursing him, and he was an impossible patient. He really was. And there was another scene in there where he had to wash his hair, and he did it in the kitchen sink. And you just looked at it and thought, that kind of doesn't feel how it was meant to be for you in the end, you know? But yeah, that's the story of E17. We really hope you've enjoyed the episode. If you've got any recollections of E17 that we failed to bring back to your attention, then do get in touch and let us know. But for now, talk to the hands.